Live from Cap Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. Water, it is precious and becoming increasingly scarce. We all want it and we all need it. It's almost the modern day version of the California Gold Rush, a valuable resource that's become increasingly difficult to count on and capture. Throw in the complications of climate change, and delivering water to the people and the farmers who need it most has been the topic of heated debate for decades. Meanwhile, the clock keeps ticking, and the amount of rain and snow critical for our water needs continues to be predictably unpredictable with extremes. That's where the Delta Tunnel or conveyance project comes in. It is highly controversial. There are passionate arguments on both sides, and late last week, the proposal cleared what appears to be a major milestone in getting it to move to the next step. Jay Lund is a professor emeritus of civil and environmental engineering at UC Davis and an expert in water resource engineering. Jay joins us now to sift through the pros and the cons of the Delta Tunnel project or the conveyance project and how it could impact all of California. Good morning, Jay.
Good morning.
So, Jay, if you head south on I-5, south of Sacramento, I mean, you'll see some signs that say, save the Delta, no water tunnels. So many of us may have heard or be aware of the Delta Tunnel project, but might not know exactly what it is. So can you just start by explaining what the Delta Conveyance Project proposal is?
So this Delta Conveyance Project proposal is to build two intakes north of along the Sacramento River, around about Cortland or Hood, and use that to supply a tunnel that has a little bit less than a 40-foot diameter down towards the intakes for the State Water Project, which are in the South Delta. So it's a way of moving high-quality water from the northern part of north part of the Delta where the Sacramento River flows in down into the California Aqueduct, which flows down to the Central Valley, the Bay Area, and Southern California.
Who would be in charge of managing it?
The Department of Water Resources would be in charge of the project and would own the project, as I understand it, and then would integrate its operations into the State Water Project and the California Aqueduct.
When it comes to, you know, the inception of, you know, maybe the first iteration of the Delta Tunnels project, I mean, it goes back governors and even decades. So when was this idea first proposed and by whom?
It was first proposed by a consulting engineer. I think it was a consultant to the state back in the 1940s as a peripheral canal. And then we had, of course, the peripheral canal that was proposed in the 1957 state water plan. And that was voted on by the people in 1982 and basically rejected by that vote, particularly by North California. So it's alive and kicking around, but it's advanced a little bit more in the last decade or so.
Mm. Why has it taken so long? I mean, I know that there are passionate debates on each side, but now that it's cleared a hurdle, an environmental impact report, which was announced by the state last week, you know, you're talking about a trajectory, a slow one at that, that has taken, you know, well over 50 years.
I think because it's controversial. You know, there are people in the Delta and Northern California that don't want to see any more water exported to the South. There are people in Southern California that feel they need additional water or need more reliability in the amount of water that they have. So it's sort of at loggerheads, I think, that way for a long time and might well continue that way.
You know, Governor Newsom, he recently streamlined environmental regulations in the name of CEQA, and this was earlier this year. And when it comes to like big infrastructure projects, so given, as I mentioned, the slow trajectory and the hurdles of this project that go back decades, did the Delta Conveyance Project benefit from this recent reform?
That remains to be seen. The state hasn't certified this EIR yet. I think that's the next thing up for the state. And then there'll be quite a few permits that have to be gotten for this project over the coming months, maybe coming years, by different federal and state agencies.
Not too long ago, like less than 3 weeks ago, we were talking with the PPIC, with Jeffrey Mount, about the site's reservoir project. And that has been given some kind of like a new breath of life. It's also a project that goes back like 70 years in Glenn and Colusa counties. And now it's being streamlined and moving forward. We're talking about two really big, massive water infrastructure projects. Are they connected? What does that say about the fact that both of these are seem to be moving forward this year?
Well, I do think that they are connected in that if you had the additional storage capacity up in the Sacramento Valley, you could capture a little bit more so-called surplus water. And the problem with that project alone is that if you can't move it across the Delta, it's harder to get it to a place where people are willing to pay a lot of money for it, a lot more money for it. So if it's just if sites is just serving farmers in the Sacramento Valley, it doesn't have as much value in terms of people willing to fund the project as if it's further south. So to some degree, the two projects benefit from each other.
Have infrastructure projects involving water of this size, have they been done in recent years? I mean, I don't think it's been done in years or maybe even decades.
Well, we had the East Side Reservoir was built in Southern California. It was 800,000 acre foot of storage capacity. That was funded entirely by people in Southern California. So we have been doing some things like this. I think we're at the tail end of major large infrastructure, dams and canals and aqueducts in terms of the development of California water.
What stands out to you about the environmental impact report that the Delta Conveyance Project it cleared last week?
It doesn't. I mean, it's a very precise document for addressing the legal requirements of the California Environmental Quality Act, but it's not a very informative document on what are the benefits and costs to different groups, what are the real risks to different fish species, environmental species, what are the benefits for some of those species as well.
Mm. What is the next step then for this project? I mean, how does it move forward? And really, how long would it even take to get built and completed?
Well, I think it has to get permitted first. So as I said, there's maybe a dozen or more, maybe a couple dozen permits that have to be gotten from a variety of federal and state agencies. And then after that, you'll have to have people agree to finance this project, which is, quite a few billion dollars. And the state has been saying that it's not going to come from the general funds of the general budget of the state of California. So it will come from water users. And that's I think, a very good tradition of the state water project, that it's funded overwhelmingly by the users. And then it has to be built. And in all of that period, there'll be opportunities for lawsuits, and I think we'll see quite a few.
Do you think it could take years or decades?
Oh, decades.
Decades. When it comes to, obviously it's been controversial for quite some time. Walk us through who's opposed to it and why.
Well, there's always concerns by people in the Delta because of disruptions to to agriculture, recreation, livelihoods, just the normal ways of living. People don't like disruptions, and I think with good reason quite often. There's a lot of environmental concerns about anything big that's built. Certainly on the local scale, you'll have disruptions of habitat of different kinds over time. And then in the long term, any changes in the movement of water, as bad as it is now for the environment, there's concerns that it might make it worse. There's an idea that the less water you take out of the Delta, the better it is for the ecosystems. And I think in some ways that's true, but the system down there is really pretty complex. So I think we have to really think about things a lot more carefully.
If the permitting moves forward and the project continues or will get built, I mean, will this have an impact to property owners along this, 45-mile track that the tunnel will go through?
For a few of them that have the tunnel access pits, I think they'll see some effects on their property values and their accessibility and the like. But I think for most of them, one of the advantages of having a tunnel rather than a peripheral canal, which was the original sets of proposals, is that it goes underneath a lot of the impacts. It avoids a lot of the surface impacts.
You know, because that's one of the arguments that proponents will say, that, you know, it helps protect against earthquake damage to the existing system, because this will essentially be built along or even near the San Andreas Fault. And the State Water Project is, what, 50, 60 years old? I mean, how will this tunnel kind of help mitigate the risks of damage from an earthquake?
The Delta, well, anything in California is at some risk for earthquakes. I mean, this is the part of the state. A major earthquake in the Delta has potential to cause many levees to fail, which would be certainly devastating for the local landowners, but unfortunately we don't have very many residents in that part of the world. But it would also disrupt the water operations for Delta exports, which require pulling water from the Sacramento Valley through the Delta and then to the export canals and aqueducts. So if you had that disrupted and you had salt water coming in from all the way into the Delta because of the earthquake and the failure of the levees, the thought is that that would disrupt water exports, water users for at least several months and maybe up to a couple of years.
Given that a realistic timeline is not years, but decades. And when we get projections when it comes to climate change that the state will release, I mean, they're talking about like 2040. I mean, so by the time that the tunnel is built, wouldn't it be too late?
Well, if you have an earthquake before the tunnel is completed, perhaps. But I think the thought is that this is a very long-term kind of proposition, that you have to a lot of infrastructure you build for the long term. I-80, we don't rebuild it every 10 years. You know, we build it for the very long term. And there's some risks involved when you do that, because technologies and such can change. But I think we often see quite a lot of value to taking a long-term perspective on fundamental infrastructure.
You know, it's also costly, and you got to figure out a way to pay for it. And I know there's going to be a lot of stakeholders that will be involved in this. But are there other alternative, cost-effective ways to move water south and just to drier areas of the state?
Well, I think probably this is likely to be the most cost-effective way of moving water from the north to the south, or continuing to maintain about the same exports of water from the north to the south. The amount of the ability of the projects to move water from north to south is diminishing with climate change. And to a large extent, this proposal is to try to slow down the rate of that reduction over time.
Given that California is currently facing a deep budget shortfall, I mean, I think the projection is $68 billion. Are there any thoughts on any impact this could have to the Delta Conveyance Project?
There might be some impacts in terms of the ability of state agencies to have the funds to do the permitting, but the general idea, as I understand it, is to have the water users pay the entire capital cost and construction costs of this project.
Given that this has cleared a recent hurdle for the modern iteration of like the Delta now single tunnel project, I mean, you have such a depth of expertise and perspective when it comes to water infrastructure and projects in the state. I mean, what do you think the likelihood is that it'll move forward?
I think there's maybe a 25 to 40% chance that this particular project will move forward and eventually be built, perhaps with some variant of it. But I think there's a very good chance that it will not reach completion. It certainly is going to require more than one governor to sign on to it over the course of its permitting and construction.
Jay, thank you so much for the time.
You're welcome.
Jay Lund is a professor emeritus of civil environmental engineering at UC Davis and an expert in water resource engineering, discussing the Delta Conveyance Project, which just cleared an environmental impact report last week. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, CAP Radio. I'm Vicki Gonzalez.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. Women make up roughly half of all medical students, but that doesn't trickle down to all specialties. While obstetrics and gynecology, immunology, and pediatrics are some examples dominated by female physicians, hovering in the 70 to 80%, surgeons are typically male-dominated professions, and orthopedics ranks at the bottom, in the single digits, which is 7% of practicing female surgeons. We're going to go straight to the source to better understand why that's the case. Dr. Michelle James is a pediatric hand surgeon as well as an emeritus chief of orthopedic surgery, and Dr. Claire Mansky is an orthopedic surgeon. Both work at Shriner Children's Northern California, and they're joining us ahead of a weekend event designed to encourage and empower young women across Sacramento area high schools to explore careers in orthopedic surgery and engineering. Welcome to you both.
Thank you.
Good morning.
Dr. James, I want to start with you. I mean, orthopedics, it's a broad specialty. Many people might not know all the nuances of it if they don't come into contact with it. What does it encompass?
So orthopedics is the care of the musculoskeletal system, primarily surgical, but a lot of what we do is non-surgical. And there's multiple subspecialties within orthopedics that include pediatric orthopedics, hand surgery, sports medicine, spine, et cetera.
What drew you to the field?
It's a long, complicated story, but what primarily drew me to the field of hand surgery once I decided on what drew me to orthopedics was that I saw that orthopedic surgeons were happy with their work when I was a medical student. And then what drew me to hand surgery was the anatomy and the detail of what we do.
Hmm. For those unfamiliar with Shriner Children's, Northern California, you've been with the hospital for more than 30 years. Tell us about its mission.
Oh, the mission of Shriners is what draws us to work there. Shriners is a wonderful organization that serves kids with specific diagnoses without regard for ability to pay, primarily surgical subspecialties. Shriners has been in Sacramento on the UC Davis campus since 1997. And the hospital originally started in San Francisco in 1923.
Yeah, that's wonderful. Even despite an inability to pay, I mean, that is huge for a lot of families.
Yeah, and especially because we provide subspecialty care. So primary care is pretty widely available to kids in California, but subspecialty care is much more challenging.
Mm. Dr. Mansky, that brings me to you. What drew you to pediatric orthopedic surgery?
I think what drew me to pediatric orthopedics is just the satisfaction of working with patients and families. When you care for children, you're not just caring for an individual, but also parents and other family members who are supporting them. And I think you build a lifelong relationship with them. We often meet families with a newborn infant, and then we follow them as they grow. We see them meet their developmental milestones. We help them accomplish their goals. And so it's a really satisfying, meaningful relationship for both, I think, the family and the child, but also the practitioner.
What conditions do you focus on the most?
So Dr. James and I are both pediatric upper extremity surgeons. So we take care of children who have birth differences of the upper arm. So that includes things like not born with the typical amount of fingers or deformities or differences of the upper extremity. We also take care of nerve injuries that are sustained at birth, other neuromuscular conditions, things like cerebral palsy, and then we help take care of kids who have had traumatic injuries. So they were born with a typical limb, but then they sustained an injury that changed the function and appearance.
Mm. Given that, you know, roughly half of women are currently medical students, according to the NIH, I mean, I was surprised to find out that there's such a small fraction of women practicing orthopedic surgery or even residents currently for orthopedic surgery. I mean, why do you think that is? Dr. James, you're a veteran in this field.
I think there's a number of reasons. It's multifactorial. The training for orthopedic surgery is about 10 years after college, and it's pretty intense. Any surgical subspecialty training is pretty intense. So that's one factor. There's no difference in women or men's ability to complete arduous training. It's just that that training tends to occur at a time in life when women may want to prioritize other things. And our specialty does not accommodate that. And other specialties do, or at least is not yet accommodated as well as it could. So that's a part of it. There's also a sort of a misunderstanding that it takes a lot of physical strength to be an orthopedic surgeon. And some of the things that orthopedic surgeons do do require physical strength, but most of the time we can accomplish those in other ways.
Dr. Mansky, how did you come to understand why there's such a small representation of women in this field?
I think in part there's a small representation of women because you can't be what you don't see. And historically, there have not been as many women. And so when I was a medical student and you don't see other women or other people that you identify with, you know, in that field leading lives that you would like to have and serving as role models, I think that can deter some people. So I think part of the solution is, you know, is having people existing in the field serving as role models and really exposing people, especially women and other people underrepresented in this field, to the field earlier and showing them that this field is for you and we need you in this field.
Yeah, of course, there's like the overall consequence of like a lack of gender equity, but really there's other harmful consequences, I would imagine, when a medical field is predominantly only one demographic or one gender.
That's true, and that's borne out in the medical literature. We know that patient care improves when the healthcare workforce is diverse, and especially care of underrepresented individuals improves when the workforce includes individuals that look like the patients that we treat and is representative of our patient population.
Hmm. Dr. James, you're also a professor, correct, of orthopedic surgery?
Yes.
So you get a different view at this as well. I mean, what do you learn from women who are medical students seeking residencies and, you know, kind of what they're drawn towards and maybe why historically, you know, they haven't, you know, gone into orthopedic surgery?
I think what Claire mentioned is a big part of it. If we see, you know, ahead of us, senior to us, people who don't look like us in a certain field, that tends to make us steer away from it. We do, we try to, and I'm sure this is what we're going to be talking about, but we do try to make sure that younger medical students get exposed to orthopedic surgery so they see that it's possible for them.
When did you first become aware of orthopedics?
Well, my father was an orthopedic surgeon, so I became aware of it from that, of course. That made me shy as far away from it as I possibly could. And I planned on other specialties for a while, but sort of came back to it when I saw what a satisfying specialty it is to work with patients to on things that are important to them. I mean, everybody's function is important to them, their ability to do things that they like to do, and that it's very gratifying to help them with that.
Dr. Mansky, what drew you to orthopedics? When did you first become aware of this field?
Well, I similarly had a father who was an orthopedic surgeon. So I too was exposed earlier, and similar to Dr. James, I thought that I would never pursue a career in that field. But as I became an adult, I really realized what a satisfying career my father had, how much meaning he derived from being able to help individuals and really help children and their families. And I just felt that, like, what there could be no better way to spend your time than contributing to the betterment of an individual or your community. And I felt that medicine and orthopedic surgery was a way to do that for me.
Given that you both obviously are female orthopedic surgeons at Shriners Children's in Sacramento, is this hospital an outlier in representation?
It is, for a couple of reasons, I think. One is just mathematical. Within orthopedics, women are underrepresented across all the subspecialties, but the subspecialties where there are starting to be more women are pediatric orthopedics and hand surgery. So there are more women going into those fields. It's still a small number. Mm. And I think women are also drawn, and men too, of course, to the mission of being able to take care of kids without regard for ability to pay.
Yeah. Before we dive into the weekend event, I want to touch upon kind of the fact that, you know, you talk about representation shapes patient care, not just, you know, equity and having a medical field that reflects the diversity of the community that they serve. But Dr. Mansky, I mean, it also impacts research as well. And you're currently working on research right now.
Yes, that's true. So we treat a variety of conditions at Shriners that we don't know what causes many of these conditions. And we've historically, the literature has focused on many sort of biological factors or mechanical factors as, you know, leading to these conditions. But we've conducted research at Shriners that shows that there are disparities in the prevalence of these conditions based on race and ethnicity and other demographic factors that may not be explained just by the biologic or mechanical factors that have been investigated. So my research is, or our research at Shriners is focused on, are there other factors that might contribute to these conditions? Access to prenatal care, socioeconomic status, other factors that we consider social determinants of health. And what's important about that is many of those factors are modifiable. If we improve prenatal care access and social determinants of health, we may actually improve or prevent many of the conditions that that we see and that kids need surgery for later on in life. Mm.
The same condition can manifest differently in different people.
That is absolutely true. And not only the physical aspects of the condition, but, you know, a patient's experience of that condition, the functional limitations or the disability that it imposes might vary from person to person based on a variety of factors that we don't traditionally consider medical.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio, and if you're just joining us, I'm talking with Dr. Michelle James and Dr. Claire Mansky. They are two pediatric orthopedic surgeons at Shriners Children's Hospital in Sacramento, discussing about the lack of women in the field of orthopedics. And now we're going to get to solutions. So a solution is taking place this weekend, and it's starting with empowering young women at area high schools to just be aware of orthopedics and also engineering. This is in partnership with the Perry Initiative. So, Dr. James, tell us about this organization.
This is a wonderful organization that was started by a colleague of Dr. Mansky's and mine about 15 years ago. And her purpose, this is Dr. Lisa Latanza, her purpose was to introduce high school girls to orthopedics and engineering as possibilities because a lot of kids didn't know that these fields existed or were something that they could have access to. And this is it. The Perry Initiative takes the form of a workshop. It's a weekend workshop. There are two parts of it. One is for high school girls, the other for medical students. And they are held in partnership with UC Davis. They're held at the nursing school at UC Davis and co-sponsored by Shriners and UC Davis. And the purpose of this is to bring these girls into a lecture room and then a lab with a group of female orthopedic surgeons, residents, and there are lectures about the field, and then there are hands-on that Dr. Mansky can talk about a little more detail that are really exciting.
And this is taking place on Saturday, and it's for students who identify both as female or even non-binary as well across schools in our area. And the mock surgical exercises are pretty cool. So tell us about what they're in for.
Yes, so this is the favorite part of the day for me. Essentially, we have several different workstations, each of which represents a different surgery in orthopedics. And so we have workstations on fracture fixation, suturing, spinal fusion procedures, ligament repairs and reconstructions like ACL procedures in the knee. And there are all of these stations are staffed by female orthopedic surgeons and residents. And we essentially teach the girls and young women at the Perry Initiative how to perform many of the skills and procedures that we use on a daily basis as orthopedic surgeons. So they learn how to drill, they learn how to place screws in these synthetic bones that we use, they learn how to apply plates, they learn suturing techniques, and just many of the principles that we use in orthopedics, and they get the hands-on experience. So the idea is that we get them interested, excited, and realize they can do this. They are capable of learning and doing this, and this is a fun and meaningful way to spend their time and a career they should consider pursuing.
Given that this isn't the first year that Shriners or the Perry Initiative has hosted an event like this, what has the response been like in years past?
The response has been great. We were one of the first hospitals to host this because of our association with the person who started it, and we've continued to do so for 15 years. We have 20 to 30 girls in each group each year. There are about 50 program sites around the country, and it's estimated that about 18,000 girls have participated since this started. And the Perry Initiative staff is starting to study, or is well into studying, the outcomes of this. And they've actually found that 90% of the high school participants matriculate into majors in science, technology, engineering, and math. And about 20% of med students match into orthopedic surgery residency, which is an excellent match rate. So there's some early indication that this actually is having effects further down the pipeline.
Yeah, I would imagine when you're that age, I know I'm including myself in this. I mean, you weren't even aware that it's possible.
That's true.
You know, and awareness is very powerful. Mm-hmm. You know, given that this event is also tied to engineering, why pair in engineering with orthopedics?
Well, I think both certainly are fields in which women are underrepresented, and I think many women don't envision going into. So I think they share that commonality. I think there are other commonalities. I mean, orthopedics is a very, there are elements that are similar to engineering in terms of, you know, principles and the way we think about doing the surgery. In many ways, engineering or orthopedic surgery is engineering applied in a human context. And we often work closely with engineers, I mean, less so in our subspecialty, but there is a lot of overlap between orthopedic implant design and engineering. And so, you know, orthopedic surgeons interact and conduct research with engineers all the time.
Given that the Perry Initiative has been around for more than a decade, I mean, how have these outreach programs like this grown in that time? I mean, you mentioned now there's thousands of young girls, you know, across the country that are being exposed to this. I would imagine it started small and just gained momentum over the time.
It did. It started with just a few centers and has now, there's over 50 doing it this year. So, yeah, it has gained momentum, and that's really exciting.
Yeah. What do you think that signals? What does that say?
I think it says that what we're doing is working, that exposure to orthopedic surgery in other STEM fields in this kind of forum is appealing to people. It may not provide the whole solution to, you know, increasing female representation in these underrepresented fields, but this is certainly an effective modality to increase representation of women in orthopedics and ultimately improve care of our patients.
Yeah, I think about the barriers. I mean, you mentioned that this subspecialty, I mean, it's a long academic road, you know, to actually become orthopedic surgeons like yourselves. And I would imagine not only what you want to do in your personal life and other goals you may have, but cost can also be prohibitive, you know, paying for tuition.
Yes, that's absolutely true.
You know, finally, what do you both get out of events like this? I mean, I know what you get out of being a pediatric hand surgeon, but what do you get about, you know, kind of shaping and empowering a younger generation?
It's incredibly fun. I think one of the joys of my work is to be able to mentor young women. And this is like just the height of it. And one of the most exciting things that we've noticed recently, a couple of my partners and I, is that our patients hear about this and become interested. So there is on perryinitiative.org, girls can self-refer. And they don't have to be recruited through their high school. So we're going to have some of our patients there this year.
And what do you get out of it, Dr. Manske?
It's just incredibly rejuvenating. I love seeing the enthusiasm of girls and young women connecting with the activities we're doing, connecting with us as mentors, and just giving them a little spark of inspiration that they have the capacity to sort of, you know, carry on through their education. And just to sort of open someone's eyes that this is a possibility, the world needs you in this regard, it's just so satisfying.
If someone's listening to this, either, you know, a young woman in high school or a parent or guardian, and they're interested in learning more, maybe being part of it next year, how do they learn more and get in touch and apply for it?
So the best place to go is perryinitiative.org. That's the website for this program. On that website includes a list of the events, where they are, their location. There's also a link to the application process, which is essentially writing an essay about why you're interested in the Perry Initiative and why you want to participate.
Dr. James and Dr. Manske, thank you so much for the time and the conversation.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Dr. Michelle James and Dr. Claire Manske are two pediatric orthopedic surgeons at Shriner Children's in Sacramento, discussing the lack of women in the field and an event trying to solve that this weekend. Shriners is hosting high school female and non-binary students and giving them a hands-on experience of what it's like to be an orthopedic surgeon as well as an engineer. The event is in partnership with the Perry Initiative. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
Welcome back to Insight on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. With the holiday season in full swing, you might be busy gift shopping for family or friends, but what should you get the music lovers on your list? How about a collection of remastered hits, unreleased tracks, artwork, and memorabilia that showcase the peak of a musician's career or the origins of their rise to fame? We are talking about CD box sets, of which 2023 has really seen no shortage of notable releases. And what has become an annual tradition here on Insight, the co-founder and announcer of KZAP, Dennis Newhall, joins us to talk about these sets and their giftability. And he's brought with him some of the most notable collections from this year, covering classic rock, folk, everything in between. Hey, Dennis, nice to see you.
Good morning, Vicki.
So someone may be doing like a double take, like, what? I just got my Spotify Wrapped of the Year. You know, why are you recommending CDs in the age of streaming and online music?
What kind of gift is that?
I know.
No, CDs, I'm a physical product person, and CDs are the most accurate representation of what went on in the studio, especially now with new modern technology. And these sets are beautiful. These make great gifts. A certificate that says you've got another year on Spotify. Maybe a stocking stuffer down at the bottom of the stocking.
Yeah, it may be convenient when you're driving in your car, Going for a walk, you know. How do CDs stack up against vinyls? Because vinyls are kind of popular, too.
Vinyl sales are up again. CD sales are up this year. And the funny thing is, to me, is that CDs tend to be half to a third the price of vinyl. Mm-hmm. They last longer and they're easier to deal with. But people like those big records. I mean, I spent most of my life playing around with LPs, so I know the feeling.
Given that this is your third year sharing like the best gift box sets of just iconic legendary musicians, I mean, I you get a kick out of it. I mean, it must be so much fun going through this throughout the year.
I like bonus tracks. I like things that haven't been out before, and especially now, again, with the new technology. A lot of these live tracks and demos and everything else sound terrific.
And there's more than music in some of the sets, right?
Oh, wow. Bob Dylan has put out a whole series. He's on about the 18th volume of the bootleg series, which is vault stuff. And about half of them come in big boxes with two books, lots of pictures, stories about the music, and the music itself. So they're beautiful pieces.
Mm. Well, let's get to Bob Dylan. The box set is the complete Budokan 1978, and that was released actually last month, so not too long ago. You know, what do you like about this one?
Well, it was two shows split in February, mid-February, and then March 1st, 1978, and they just put it out in Japan first years ago. Didn't even make an American release, but finally they did. If you're a Bob Dylan fan, if you're a completist, and if you just want better sound quality, this is a good one. But I will tell you, Bob was on the road with a horn section, a flute player, backup singers, and doing his usual thing where he'll rework songs so you don't even know what it is till you're halfway in the middle, like reggae treatments of some songs that you're familiar with. I'm not really sure about the flute on some of these. So this, as far as Bob Live, this is not necessarily everybody's favorite. But again, if you liked it, mm-hmm. if you're a completist, it's a beautiful set. It comes with 12 more titles that weren't on the original, plus two versions of some of the songs that were on the original album. So it's a big one, and it's nice, and it sounds great. It's just that it's an odd period of Bob, because he just went out there and said, I'm going to do it this way this time.
Well, and that's great, because now I understand, because previous albums have had part of these concerts, but these are like the concerts
this
incomplete.
Whole thing, yeah.
The whole shebang.
Right.
Well, let's take a listen to one of them. This is All Along the Watchtower.
No reason to get excited.
You know, it's good when the the Insight team in the booth is bouncing around behind us.
Bob was in good voice back then.
Yeah, too. I love the fiddle, right?
It's very unusual. I'm not sure about the flute. Still not sure. When you hear that, you'll know what I'm talking
yeah.
about.
Yeah. Okay, so up next, we have a box set from The Who, and this has an interesting backstory.
This is the brick of the
season. Oh, my.
Season.
Wow, yeah, that is huge.
Album-sized. Back in the late 60s, Pete Townsend was working on a project called Lifehouse, and before that, mid-60s, Pete Townsend had a full home studio, so he would make demos that were pretty much complete songs, ready to go if they wanted to, take them to The Who and say, okay, you guys play this exactly as it is, and Roger, you sing it. And he had enough for a 2-LP set that had a whole story with it, much like Tommy. But then they decided to pare it down to one album, which was the Who's Next, which some people consider their best album. So it wasn't a loss. Several of the songs from that ended up on compilations, and then Pete Townsend has put out a series of his demos. But this one has all of it, including a lot of stuff that's never been released before. And when it's a Pete Townsend demo, it sounds like it's right out of the studio. It doesn't sound like he was sitting out in the garage with a cassette player. Plus, two full concerts, one from San Francisco and one from the Old Vic in England, only part of which have come out in the past. So some of this has been out, but most of it has not. And the remaster of Who's Next is pretty darn good.
Given that this is a CD box set, I mean, it's really big. What else is in it?
There's two hardbound books. One is memorabilia. One is the story of Lifehouse with a graphic novel that he always had in mind, too. And then there's two folders in there that have 8 CDs. This is one that I don't think, I'm not sure, but I don't think it has come out in an LP version, because even the CD version is $300, so the LP version would probably be twice that.
Wow.
But for LP fans, you know, some of these are available on vinyl.
Well, let's listen to Teenage Wasteland.
Don't need to fight.
Okay, so that brings up an important point. How much do these box sets kind of range in price? If you want to buy one for yourself, they are collector's items, or a gift for someone else.
Well, the Who one is up there at $300, although if you shop carefully, you can find it for two-thirds that. There's one coming up, though, that I think is the bargain. We'll talk about that in a second. I did want to say, though, that that song, if you didn't recognize it, turned into Baba O'Reilly. I mean, that was one of their biggest songs, and that's the seeds of that song. So there's a lot of that stuff on.
Yeah, that is awesome. And yeah, demo of, from the Lifehouse, The Who. And now we're going to move on to The Doors.
And this is not really a box, but it's considered a box set. It's The Matrix, which was a club in San Francisco, owned partly by Marty Balin from the Jefferson Airplane. The Doors, right after their first album came out. So they're still young and hungry. And they're good. Some of this has been out before, but now it sounds much better. And this is all, for the most part, of three different nights at the Matrix. So The Doors at the Matrix, I think, is worthwhile for any Doors fan.
And when it comes to, I guess, the dollar point, that is a steal? Is that
Well, yeah, actually, for three CDs, it's not bad. The best one, though, is the next one we're going to listen to.
Yep. Okay, well, let's take a quick listen to The Doors. Break on through to the other side.
You know, the day destroys the night, night divides the day. Try to run, try to hide, break on through to the other side. Break on through to the other side, break on through to the other side, yeah. We chased our pleasures here, dug our treasures there. Still we gone, time we cried. Break on through to the other side. Break on through to the other side. Break on through to the other side. Yeah. Yeah.
You know, what I love is that obviously we have heard this song before, but I love hearing it in different venues at different times in their career.
I think in that one, too, because it's live and it's not the record company's cutting it. He sings She Gets High instead of just She Gets. But they cut that out of the single. And it's great to hear him in a little club. When you realize they were struggling, they were nothing yet. That song was not very big until Light My Fire came along.
Yeah. Last, but of course, certainly not least, is Joni Mitchell. What do you love about this one?
Well, Joni Mitchell has had three volumes now. The first one was before she even put out a record. Five CDs worth of really well-recorded live and demos. The next one was up through Blue, which is beautiful. This is the next phase, which included Court and Spark. Five CDs, none of it ever released. It includes some sessions she did with Crosby and Nash, some sessions with Neil Young, some sessions with James Taylor. A lot of live stuff, including the Dorothy Chandler Pavilion, the Royal Festival Hall, and Carnegie Hall. And she's great live. And she didn't do that much touring that late in her career. So these are terrific sets, all three of them. And this one runs about $50.
Best bang for your buck.
It's got a nice booklet in it. And if you're a Joni fan, these things are, it's all unreleased. So it's really fun to hear.
Yeah, they are beautiful. Well, let's take a listen to Like Veil, Said Lorraine.
It's veils you tear off one by one, said Lorraine. No, it's walls we put up, said that tired voice again. The chisel gets blunt and the sword gets profane. Nobody's blame, but you bind up the stone chips in the gauze that you've slain.
Her voice.
Yeah.
Time and time again.
Inexplicably, that has never been released, that song.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wonderful. In the last 20 seconds or so that we have, any other ones that caught your eye this year?
There's a Kinks. It's actually two CD sets that covers their career and some really nice notes from the brothers Davis. There's Eric Clapton with the entire run that he did back in the early 90s. It's called The Definitive 24 Nights, and that's at the Royal Albert Hall. Stevie Nicks, complete studio albums, if you're a Stevie Nicks fan, plus rarities.
Performing tonight at Golden One Center.
And then there's also, right. And then there's also the Beatles, if you want to call it a box set. You can get the red and blue in a little box set from the Beatles site.
Dennis, thank you so much. It's always a treat.
Certainly.
Dennis Newhall is a co-founder and announcer on KZAP. That is it for Insight today. But before we go, we do have some news to pass along about Insight. We're excited to announce that Insight will be moving to the noon hour starting in January. We will keep you posted here on CAP Radio and all of our digital platforms. I'm Vicky Gonzalez. That'll do it for us. Have a great day. We'll catch you back here tomorrow.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.